He's not called the Terminator much anymore, but back in 1984, Arnold Schwarzenegger became a star playing a cyborg assassin from the future. He went on to make two more Terminator films before changing careers. The fourth Terminator film takes place in 2018, years after machines with a will of their own triggered a nuclear holocaust. It stars Christian Bale as John Connor, son of the film's first heroine, Sarah Connor. The director goes by the name of McGee and is best known for the two Charlie's Angels features. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of Terminator Salvation.
In Terminator Salvation, machines have exterminated most of humankind and now run the planet. I think they had a hand in the movie, too. It's barely storytelling. It's programming. James Cameron's 1984 The Terminator and its showy sequel, T2, were also mechanical, but their killer bots had charm. Arnold Schwarzenegger's metallic readings and bodybuilder arrogance meshed riotously well with the part of a cyborg assassin, and Robert Patrick's T2 was a witty, preternatural blank with adorably incongruous teacup handle ears. The fourth time out, the bad machines are steel skeleton effects, and most of the humans are less compelling. It's not really the fault of the actors, or even the director, McGee, who expertly storyboards the jangly fights and chases and crashes and explosions. As I said, it's the machines, or more precisely, the fearsome Hollywood machine that sifts through books and old movies in search of the holy franchise, then generates non-essential sequels. The Terminator began with a cyborg villain and a human hero, Kyle Reese, traveling back to 1984 from the future. Terminator Salvation is how they try to get to the point where they go back, if that makes any sense. In 2018, John Connor, played by Christian Bale, the son of the original heroine, Sarah Connor, and destined to be mankind's savior, must defeat the nefarious, machine-run corporation Skynet and send Reese to 1984 to save Connor's mom and also get her pregnant so she'll have John Connor. Of course, every time trip has its perils, just as the Vulcans in the new Star Trek. Maybe in this time loop, Skynet will kill John before he kills them, and humanity will perish. Don't you love these ridiculous time travel permutations? Alas, the movie isn't as much fun as it could be. With McGee's migraine-inducing jerky cam and monochromatic brown palette, livened only by splotches of rust, Terminator Salvation is numbing. There is, however, a novel element, a second protagonist, Sam Worthington's Marcus Wright, who's executed by lethal injection in the movie's prologue, set in the 1990s. But first, he signs away his body to a terminally ill scientist, played by Helena Bonham Carter. In a post-nuclear holocaust 2018, he bounds naked from some wreckage, looking remarkably buff. Is he a cyborg? Something has been done to him. When he confronts Bale's surly John Connor, he has to convince the resistance fighter that they're on the same side.
They know what you are, even if you don't.
Enough! That gun ain't gonna stop.
Nobody shot you in the heart, and I see that thing beating a mile a minute.
Kyle Reese! He's in Skynet. You do that, he's dead. I can get you in.
How? Look at me. That's why I don't trust you. I'm the only hope you have. I need to find who did this to me. So do you.
I won't deprive you of the pleasure of figuring out Marcus's secret for yourself about an hour and a half before it's revealed. The key is that he doesn't know himself what his purpose is, and he's furious about it. Sam Worthington is an Australian actor who had a brief but vivid role as a handsome hooligan in Greg McLean's delectable killer crocodile picture Rogue, now on DVD and highly recommended. He manages to suggest a soul in torment with a minimum of inflection, and he gives the movie what innards it has. It would be nice if Terminator Salvation centered on him, since Bale is a big drag. Millions have viewed via YouTube Bale's abusive tantrum on the set of this film, and the interesting thing is that he's equally unpleasant on camera. Connor's mission here is the apogee of sci-fi nuttiness, to find his dad, a teenager, and keep him alive long enough to impregnate his mom and save the world from an army of titanium-girded Austrian musclemen. But as mankind's savior, Bale is such a sour prig, you wonder why he doesn't terminate himself out of spite.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.
It's Judgment Day for the latest Terminator movie. Terminator Salvation is the fourth chapter in the series about killer machines, and it's the first not to star Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's been busy trying to terminate California's budget crisis. Bob Mondello has a review.
You'd think The End of the World, which more or less happened in the third Terminator flick, would take some of the pressure off a series, but fans have still been fretting about this new movie. Christian Bale threw a temper tantrum on the set, then got upstaged by his unknown co-star, Sam Worthington, and it did not exactly inspire confidence that the director's previous hits were both Charlie's Angels movies. Of course, some might consider that perfect training for a story about wiping out all of humanity. Gives you a reason, no?
Come with me if you want to live.
That line is a quote from Terminator 2, one of several in-jokes in the new film that will amuse fans, but that don't exactly brighten with comedy, a movie that is very effectively grim. We're no longer in an hasta la vista, baby world. We've leaped ahead to 2018, post-apocalypse. The machines have done their dirty work, and humanity is on the...
Run!
Charlie's Angels, it's not. Director McGee, borrowing a technique from war movies, so drains the screen of color he almost seems to be shooting in black and white. Happily, his way with special effects is indeed special, whether he's sending giant metal transporters to snatch up people like peanuts from a bowl, or mechanical eels to thrash the audience to death. It's a little odd when an enormous transformer-like thingy wanders on shedding deadly motorcycles as if they were fleas. It looks like an escapee from a much dumber summer movie. But it still helps make Terminator Salvation breathless and nerve-jangling. If it's not really engaging emotionally, well, the Terminator franchise sort of teaches you not to get too attached to its good guys. Christian Bale is either the fourth, fifth, or sixth actor to play John Connor, depending on whether you count the TV series and the flashbacks. And given the rather wayward way these films have with time travel, if he makes one wrong step in some future past, the character might not even exist next time around. But then, if you want an extended relationship, you probably shouldn't be at a franchise called Terminator, right? I'm Bob Mondello.
In the 1920s, while Bonnie and Clyde were still teenagers in that Dallas slum, Noel Coward's creations were flitting through a very different social scene. There's a new movie version of Coward's roaring 20s play, Easy Virtue, in theaters this weekend. And as NPR's Bob Mondello discovered, this story has some surprising cinematic roots.
The new film Easy Virtue is filled with the sort of chatter and situations for which Noel Coward was famous. Wealthy sophisticates sipping cocktails and cracking wise about marriage and life and really important things like tennis.
The Titanic could have hit that. Sarah, you're an embarrassment to the Hearst family name. I'm going to have you killed.
I'm going to guess that crack was not penned by Noel Coward, but Stephen Elliott's adaptation keeps his basic storyline and the generally light tone.
Nice. Backhand.
Was that a backhand compliment?
Jessica Biel plays Loretta, a glamorous American with a scandalous secret she has not confided to her much younger new husband. This is sensible because he's a bit of a twit, still under the influence of a manipulative mother who expected him to continue living on the family's country estate, not with a wife in London.
But what will John do in the city?
Work. It's not uncommon.
John was brought up in the country, Larita. Where will he work?
Now, with a Noel Coward play, the dialogue and its brittle, upper-crusty delivery count for everything. So it's kind of intriguing that there was a previous film version of Easy Virtue and that it was a silent movie. Coward's play was optioned almost as soon as it hit the London stage in 1925, and a youngster named Alfred Hitchcock, in his 20s at the time, was hired to direct. How does his version compare? Well, for one thing, it's pure melodrama, not comedy. Larita's scandalous past, barely mentioned in the new film or the play, takes up nearly a quarter of the silent picture's running time. Her drunken first husband, adultery, a shooting, a divorce trial, all are laid out in elaborate detail and with touches of the Hitchcock that audiences would later learn to love for his wry sense of humor. The leading lady is introduced as an on-screen blur, for instance, and only comes into focus when the judge puts on his glasses. Hitchcock, the master craftsman, is already at work. But consider his dilemma. He's adapting a celebratedly witty piece of writing, but can barely use any of Noel Coward's words. Just one verbal joke remains from the original play. On a title card, John's battle axe of a mother baits Larita with the question, "Have you had as many lovers as they say?" Larita, ever classy, replies, "Of course not. Hardly any of them actually loved me." Vintage Noel Coward, that. Coward was mocking the smugness of the rich folks, and Hitchcock finds lots of ways to get that across, but he treats the story as the melodrama it always was underneath, about a hypocritical family and a lady with a past who knows more about morality than they do. Because Hitch was not making a comedy, the rhythms he adopts are stately. Almost nothing in his silent version of Easy Virtue happens very quickly. But one thing does. If you rent it, keep an eye out during the tennis scene for a slightly bulky gentleman with a walking stick striding away from the camera and through a gate. You never see his face, but if you've seen any of Hitchcock's other movies, you'll recognize a very early instance of what was to become a signature moment, a discreet nod to the audience from a cinematic showman who was then an unformed, but already very confident, 28-year-old. I'm Bob Mondello.
Sarah Borges and the Broken Singles is a Boston-area band raised on punk rock and country music. Their new album, The Stars Are Out, contains 5 original songs and 5 covers from artists ranging from the Lemonheads to NRBQ. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The album is called The Stars Are Out, with a picture of a glittering night sky on the cover to make sure you don't think the title is a pun, because Sarah Borges and the Broken Singles are certainly not stars. The group's primary charm, communicated very well on this album, is that it's an old-fashioned bar band playing a mixture of original material and covers of others' hits. What lifts The Stars Are Out above the work of most bar bands is that Borges and her cohorts are able to put their own mark on the material they didn't write, such as this nicely moody version of a Stephen Merritt Magnetic Field song called No One Will Ever Love You.
If you don't mind, why don't you mind? Where's your sense of indignation? You are too kind, much too
I'd wager the line that caught Sarah Borges' ear in that song was, "No one will ever love you honestly." Since the honesty and dishonesty in relationships runs through her recordings like an electrical current. When you combine that theme with the band's fondness for the pop side of punk rock, it's no wonder they latched onto this fine, semi-obscure song by Any Trouble. That was a British band that recorded for Stiff Records, once home to Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe, among many others.
I don't want to be your lover. I just want to hold you for the rest of the night. You couldn't want me another. Girls in your eyes and now you keep out the light. We both know that it's wrong. But we've been together now for so long. I can't give you anything but here and now. I didn't want to be here with you anyhow. The only thing I got for you is yesterday's love. Take it or you can't.
No No Boston area band of the past 40 years seems able to have escaped the influence of one of that city's signature acts, the Jay Giles Band. As Borges and the Broken Singles demonstrate with their own composition, I'll Show You How. It's a chunk of bluesy rock featuring honking harmonica fills reminiscent of Giles Band member Magic Dick. Sarah Borges and the three guys who form the Broken Singles build their own material not just around Borges' voice, which can cut across the guitars like a knife, but also around their shared fondness for pop music history, mixing and matching. Take, for example, Me and Your Ghost, in which Borges does some channeling of Leslie Gore circa It's My Party, girl group harmonies, and Mersey beat rhythms. It's a 60s throwback, free of camp or irony. The question here is whether good taste in pop music history and deft skill at reproducing a wide range of styles can cohere as something original. In this, I'm not entirely convinced. Certainly, the group's eclecticism, to paraphrase the NRBQ song they cover here, comes to them naturally. But originality can be overrated. Sometimes, coming up with a great set list for your live act, which is basically what The Stars Are Out amounts to as a collection of songs, is its own reward. Listen to Sarah Borges and the Broken Singles, and you want to get out of your house or apartment and hear some live music. In this, the band is a fine motivator, a reminder of how much fun music can be, making it and hearing it, being played by people for whom it means absolutely everything, a feeling they just want to share.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Stars Are Out by Sarah Borges and the Broken Singles. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.